Good evening and welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, I'm the director here, and I'm really delighted to welcome you to this conversation on global issues with a friend of mine, our guest, Stephen Hadley. Since the November 2016 election, President Trump has dominated the international conversation, and this week is no different. Over the weekend, Mr. Mueller delivered his report, and so far he seems to have satisfied precisely no one. So I would say this is a good week to host somebody like Steve Hadley, but actually every week is a good week to host an American visitor these days. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Hadley is one of the most respected and experienced foreign policy makers in the US Capitol. From 2005 to 2009, he served as the National Security Advisor to President George W. Bush. From 2001 to 2005, Mr. Hadley was President Bush's Deputy National Security Advisor, serving under then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. He previously served on the National Security Council staff and in the Defense Department. He now serves as a principal at Rice Hadley Gates and as chair of the Board of Directors of the United States Institute of Peace. Let me say this biography, impressive though it sounds, doesn't do Steve justice. He is what in more genteel days was termed a wise man. He's a Republican, he's a proud Republican, I'm sure, but he's not a partisan. He has friends on both sides of the aisle and around the world, including here at the Institute. When I took on the role of executive director in 2012, one of the early things we did was stand up a Distinguished International Fellow program by which we would bring a global superstar to Australia to spend a couple of weeks with us. And Steve was the second Distinguished International Fellow. The first was Kurt Campbell on the Democratic side, and the second was Steve. And Steve and his wife, Anne, were really model guests who really impressed Australians, not only with their experience and their intelligence, but with their humility. So Steve was a really wonderful guest to have. He's here in Australia on business, but he's kindly agreed to return to the Institute this evening for one night only. So thank you. Please join me in welcoming Steve Hadley. Steve, let me start with the Mueller report, seeing as it's newsy. The report is now in the hands of the Attorney General, who has released a summary of that report, which says in essence that the team did not establish evidence of collusion, but it left it up to the Attorney General to determine whether the conduct by President Trump and his associates constituted obstruction of justice, and the Attorney General concluded it didn't. What do you think about that result? Is this a victory for US institutions in the sense that a special counsel who was being hounded incessantly by the president and by some elements of conservative news media nevertheless quietly went about his work without leaks and delivered a fair-minded centrist report that even the president is now thanking him for and now saying he's an honourable person? Or on the other side of the House, what would you say about the liberal critique of it, which is, look, he's delivered a sort of a milquetoast finding and the Attorney General has been too quick to make these conclusions. How do you feel about Mueller?
I think he did a terrific job. And he did it on an issue that was completely politicized in the American political dialogue and has been for now 2 years. He did it as a prosecutor should. He did it by the book in a non-political way. He had a terrific staff. A couple of members of his staff were indiscreet, and he got rid of them. It did not leak. It's the only thing I know recently in Washington that did not leak. And it is, I think we will find when the report itself comes out, it's a very professional, by-the-book job. And it raises, and he's pretty clear that there was no collusion, there was no cooperation between the Trump administration and the Russians in order to subvert the election, flat out. And, you know, there are a lot of people who, including the U.S. intelligence community under President Obama, who John Brennan, for example, who were very clear that in their view there was collusion. And Democratic politicians are on the record over and over again saying there was collusion. And he had the courage to say, I'd look at the evidence, and there is no collusion. And that will, I think, over time, put that issue to bed. The obstruction of justice issue is in some sense harder, but I think, as I read that letter, the better case is that indeed there wasn't something that would consist of legally prosecutable obstruction of justice. You can say that his firing, that the president's firing of Comey, his harassment of Mueller, was in the vernacular an interference with the judicial process or interference with the prosecutor. You'd have to say that. But that was not the question. The question is, was it a prosecutable obstruction of justice? And I think the Attorney General has looked at what Mueller said and has concluded the answer is no. Now, does that mean this? A couple consequences, maybe probably three consequences. One, President Trump now feels vindicated, believes it vindicates his notion that this was all, I use the phrase advisedly, trumped up. It was not a real investigation. And he will now use that politically to say he's vindicated, but he will also use it now in this drumbeat supported by Republicans to go after, well, what was the origin of the investigation? Why was it initiated? What was the basis that they used of this dossier that was used in the FISA, in going to the FISA court to get initial subpoenas and other authorities to pursue the investigation? So there will be another witch hunt, and it will be, I think, by the president and his Republican allies in here to show that this was a manufactured investigation and put the blame on the Democrats. And of course, continue to whip Hillary Clinton, which he continues to do for reasons I can't understand. So that's one consequence. Two, I think it's going to be very hard. I think those people who saw Mueller as just a device to get rid of the president through impeachment are going to be disappointed. I think it's going to be very hard to make the case for impeachment based on the Mueller report. So I think some of the winds go out of sail. And I think Nancy Pelosi and her Senate colleague have been very smart to say this should not be about impeachment. This should be about the 2020 election and about winning over the American people to replacing Trump in office. And that is the right place. This is a political issue now, and it ought to be resolved politically, not through impeachment. But the third thing is the investigations are going to go on because it is now part of the effort by Democrats to undermine Trump. And there are all kinds of House investigations primarily that are going to go forward. The Southern District of New York, the Attorney General of New York in state courts are going to be pursuing a number of inquiries. So it's going to be very noisy and very messy. And as we know about this president, as his wife said, if you hit Donald Trump, he hits you back 10 times as hard. So it's going to continue to be a fairly cacophonous political environment. And, you know, the 2020 presidential election is already on.
Let me ask you about this cacophonous political environment. Yep. And that comment that if you hit President Trump, he will hit you back even harder. And what we've found out in the last couple of weeks, he will keep hitting you even when you're dead. What did you make of that? As someone who obviously knew Senator McCain well, what explains that kind of behavior in continuing to criticize a distinguished public servant who is deceased? And I guess more importantly, does this sort of behavior from the president, does this have permanent deleterious effects for the quality of discourse in your country?
Sure. You know, it's who this guy is. He's a very unusual personality. We've never had somebody like this. I mean, and how did this come about? It came about because for a long period of time, a good chunk of the American electorate has had a real grievance about the way things are. This is, you know, a lot of it in the flyover part of the United States, the Midwest, where I come from. People who are in middle class, lower middle class jobs, hadn't seen a wage increase in a decade, could not say that they had confidence their children would live better than they did, which is the American dream and which has been the case for generations. I say these are people who felt that they had been victimized by globalization, threatened by immigration, abandoned by their politicians, and betrayed by the elites, people who did do well over the last 10 years at the expense of everybody else. And if you look at the asset accumulation in the top 1% versus the asset accumulation of the bottom 30%, it's terrible. I mean, it's awful. So, and this movement has been trying to express itself for some time. It started right after President Obama's election, when he wanted to talk about health care and everybody else wanted to talk about the deficit. He started losing elections. You had the Tea Party movement. The Republican Party tried to swallow the Tea Party movement, to take it in within the Republican Party. It turned out to be quite indigestible. Just talk to John Boehner, who lost his speakership over it. And it finally came full flower in 2016, when for the first time in history, we elected a populist insurgent as president. We've had populist movements before. We've never elected him as president of the United States. And it's because of this unaddressed set of grievances that mobilized and elected Trump. And as some of the people reflect by the constituency will say, they call it the "have you heard me yet" election. And they finally found in Trump somebody who gave expression to their grievances and who's been very zealous about saying, I'm going to keep my promises to that group. And this Twitter feed that drives us all crazy is the way he keeps in touch with his base and says to his base, I'm keeping faith with you. You keep faith with me. And, you know, and as difficult as it is to hear, the irony is that his level of popularity is roughly the same as Bill Clinton and Barack Obama at comparable times in their presidencies. So, you know, he represents a real force, and it is a force that has taken over the Republican Party, which is why the Republican leaders seem to be so craven. People say, well, why don't you stand up to Trump? Well, the answer is because Trump is incredibly popular within the Republican base. And everybody who stood up to Trump, whether it's Senator Corker, Senator Flake, or others, they all stood up with Trump, then looked at the polls and decided, I better not seek re-election because I'm going to get beat. So, you know, he is a commanding figure, and his ability, and I find it offensive, he counters sort of all the values that Midwestern kids were taught to grew up with, but the way he can demean people in a way that destroys them politically is amazing. He ran against the strongest Republican field we'd had in a generation, and he didn't just beat each one of them, he destroyed most of them. And I find it offensive, this belittling, but it is brilliant. You know, Jeff Bozo rather than Jeff Bezos. I mean, it's brilliant. The problem is he has demeaned our political discourse and coarsened it. And the problem is that all the people that are anti-Trump have followed him down and are almost as intemperate as he is. And that, I think, is the thing that is, you know, once you cross these lines of decorum and appropriateness, you don't get them back. And I think the risk is that he's permanently coarsened the discord and the divisions within our country. And the last thing I'll say, I'm sorry to run on. Everybody in Washington and the elites are focused on what Trump says and what he tweets. and they run after it, and it's one outrage after another, and he is controlling it like a puppeteer. You know, he throws something out, everybody, it gets attention, it keeps him at the center of the discussion, which he loves. It's all about him. You know, this is the American presidency as a reality show that is produced, directed, and whose only star is Donald Trump, and that's the way he likes it. But if you look at, and we can talk about some, but if you look at some of the policies he's pursuing, some of them are quite sound. And I try to say to people and my friends in the press, you know, you keep running after what he says. Why aren't you focusing about what he's doing and what's happening in the world? And that gets almost no coverage in American media today. And our politics are in a pretty bad way at the present.
I want to ask you about, I hear you on, you know, watch what President Trump does rather than what he says. And I want to ask you some specific questions about some elements of his foreign policy. But before I do that, his sort of core worldview as expressed over three decades is very unusual, as you say, for an American president. He's unimpressed by the traditional concept of American leadership. He's skeptical of alliances. He thinks allies rip America off. He's hostile to free trade. He's attracted to strongmen. Now, there's an argument about to what extent US foreign policy has been affected by those instincts, but those are clearly his views. Now, to what extent, you talked about whether the coarsening of the culture could be reversed. What I think concerns me is that having a president who has these views that have run so anathema to American history is having permanent effects, potentially, on the Republican Party, on American public opinion, and on the world's opinion of America, because we're not used to seeing a president like this. And that would be even more so, I think, if he's re-elected. If he's elected once and he loses, that's one thing. If Americans elect him twice, I wonder, won't that really permanently affect the view that the world has of the United States? So I guess my question is, from a foreign policy point of view, to what extent can America snap back when the Trump administration ends, as it eventually will end?
I think it'll snap some way back, but not all the way back. And it shouldn't be surprising. You know, he was elected because the people who voted for him, a good chunk of them, thought he would disrupt the system and turn over the tables of the money changers in the temple, if you will. That's why they voted for him. And he was elected to be a disruptor in chief, and he's done a good job of it. And he has reset the table on a whole series of issues. Now, is it all bad? Everybody says about alliances. You know, he didn't say anything that, in fact, American presidents, Secretary of Defense, with respect to NATO, haven't said for two decades, which is, you're free riders. I used to use that phrase myself when I would talk to the Europeans. You're free riders. You're riding on our back. You're not carrying your weight. The U.S. defense contribution to NATO is 70%. That's ridiculous. What he said is, you got to do your fair share, and if you don't, I may pull out. And it finally got their attention. And of course, I think where we are now is NATO is trying to step up in terms of financial input. I think they need to do more. They are trying to show that they're relevant to the war on terror and the like. It's not the way I would have done it, but you know, I've been working on trying to get our European allies to do more for a couple decades, and I didn't have much success. He has. Same thing, North Korea. We've had three administrations, Clinton administration, Bush administration, Obama administration, did deals with North Korea to try to denuclearize, get rid of their nuclear weapons. North Korea didn't stay in any of them. We all failed. And Trump comes into office and he starts, you know, threatening and raising the prospect of military action. And everybody says, oh my gosh, you know, Richard Haass said, love Richard Haass, a very close friend. He says there's a 30% chance that we'll go to war. I didn't believe it, but that's what was the sort of hysteria that gripped Washington. Well, you know, it got the Chinese attention, and they started to put pressure on Kim Jong-un, and it got Kim Jong-un's attention. And then he was offered a chance to go meet with Kim Jong-un, and everybody said, oh, you can't do that. You don't know anything about it. You got to prepare it from the ground up. And he said, I'm going to go meet with him. Why? He was right. Why? Because we've failed, because we've tried to do it from the bottom up, when the real issue is, can you convince Kim Jong-un to make a strategic shift from military first, China is your only friend, isolating your country and really keeping it a backwater, and get him to understand that he will open up, reform his economy, he will be accepted in the international community, and he will have a better legacy than his current approach. He's got to make that strategic choice, and only he can do it. And that's what Trump is really trying to do. I think he'll fail. But, you know, it's the other bottom-up traditional approach, a comprehensive agreement trying to dot every I and cross every T, hasn't worked. And he's trying to do something different. And I think all of us who failed, and there's a lot of us, ought to, you know, pipe down and hope he succeeds. So we can talk about trade. I'm not a Trump partisan in any way, shape, or form. But I try to call them the way I see them. And if we're going to have a conversation about it, we got to, yes, talk about the tweets and the degrading of the level of the dialogue, but we have to also talk about the policies and what he's trying to do. And there's a case that some of these things could work out well for the United States and the rest of the world.
But to take, let me push you on the North Korea example, if I can. I mean, I think a lot of us are sympathetic to the idea when you've got such a wicked problem and you've been trying one approach forever, okay, right, maybe you throw it out, you try something else. But you have to have an idea in your head how you can persuade Kim Jong-un to give up his nuclear weapons, which ultimately is the primary source of prestige and leverage that he has, that is the ultimate guarantor against regime change, and is the thing that is delivering this global, worldwide coverage, the prestige of being on the same stage in a bilateral meeting with the President of the United States. I mean, isn't it true that President Trump really went into those meetings having done little preparation without a proper national security process? Even last week we saw this weird exercise with the sanctions that were announced, and then he put out a tweet saying that the sanctions were being withdrawn, and then it emerged that maybe there were two different sets of sanctions. Isn't there a, what do you say to the critique that says, look, President Trump is just trying to look great. He just wants to look fantastic, and he's not really focused on the details of the deal as long as he can get something that makes sure the camera is on him and makes him look great.
I think that's too harsh. I know I've talked to Secretary Pompeo. Steve Biegun, who is the special envoy for North Korea, worked with me in the Bush administration. He is a terrific guy. And if you talk with him, he's got a strategy. And it makes a lot of sense. And I think one of the things you ought to do is you ought to get in touch with him, invite him to come to Australia next time he comes for consultations in Japan, and say, look, Australians are confused about this. Come down and explain it to you.
Can you pass that message on for us?
I can. I can do that. But I think that's a little harsh, and I think it was prepared. The problem on the preparation was they could not get the North Koreans to engage. That was the problem. You know, we had a series of things we were trying to get them to agree to start the process. Because if you basically say, you know, you got to agree, you got to give a declaration that lists every facility, nuclear facility, and you got to accept inspectors at all those facilities as the front end, you're not going to get anywhere. That's what we had in the prior two agreements, and we couldn't keep them in it. It's going to have to be a different approach. They're going to have to denuclearize over time, initially taking steps that degrade their program, that keep it from maturing, do other things that we can do, because there were four areas, lines of action outlined in the agreement that they reached in Singapore, work on some of those, build some confidence. I don't know where it ends up. I don't know whether we will fully denuclearize North Korea, but I will tell you, it could put us on a better road than we're on now. We're going to see? What we're going to see is, egged on in some sense by the criticism of Trump, North Korea is starting to do what they always do when they try to get you to agree to something and you say no. They will then come after you. They will try to undermine you. They will try to separate us from South Korea, separate us from the Japanese. I mean, we've seen this every time. And after about 18 months to 2 years, if you can hold it together and show them you're not going to back down, and they can't divide those of us who are trying to pressure them to move in the direction of denuclearization. And if President Trump is reelected, I think they'll come back to the table. But, you know, these are difficult people to deal with, and it's going to be a long process. It's going to be a long process.
What about President Trump's policy on China? What do you make of that?
He, you know, everybody's, the issue for a lot of people is tariffs. That tariffs is not a good instrument. All it does is increase the cost to American companies and to American consumers, and that's true. What Trump understood is there are not a lot of tools he could use to get the Chinese attention, and tariffs was one. So the tariffs are not an end to themselves. They're a means to an end. What's the end? The end is that there is a bipartisan agreement in the United States, Republicans and Democrats, and now almost the entire business community, that there's not a level playing field between the United States and China. That China is increasingly closing its market to foreign companies, subsidizing national champions, giving them an exclusive control or a dominance of the Chinese market, and then unleashing them on the world so they can undercut everybody else and put us, our companies, out of business. And they did it on steel, and they did it in the solar panels, and they're going to try to do it now on, you know, autonomy and artificial intelligence and these critical technologies of the 21st century. We can't let them do it. And at the same time, they started increasing their investment in Europe and the United States, buying up companies in these critical areas that they would not allow U.S. companies to participate in China. This is as unlevel and non-reciprocal as you can get. And it has to be addressed. And whether it was President Hillary Clinton or President Donald Trump, it was going to be front and center on the agenda. Trump has just been, I think, more effective and more steadfast at trying to do it. Now, there's a little bit of a disconnect here. The irony is there's a win-win solution here. If you talk to Leo He, who is the economic advisor to Xi Jinping, he would say to you, look, the Chinese economy is in a downturn. And if it is going to turn up again, we need to have more reform and opening up. We need to rely more on markets and less on state-owned enterprises. And we need to have foreign competition to make our Chinese companies more efficient. So Leo He is saying to Xi Jinping, let me have more reform and opening up, which is what started in 1979 under Deng Xiaoping, which resulted in this remarkable growth of the Chinese economy. And Leo is saying, we need to do it again. Well, that reform and opening up is exactly what the American business community wants to see China to do, because it will begin to level that playing field. So there's a win-win outcome here. But it requires the United States to stand firm and not just let China off the hook by buying more soybeans and natural gas and resources and address the balance of trade issue, which is what Trump really cares about. They've got to convince Trump, you've got to stand firm and really get some real structural reform of the Chinese economy and an enforcement mechanism, because China has a long history of agreeing to things and never implementing them. And they got to have a mechanism to hold China's feet to the fire. And that's what being discussed. And if we don't get that kind of reform now, with Trump having made such a point of it and used the tariffs and given the weakness of the Chinese economy, if we don't get it now, we'll never get it. And China will continue, quite frankly, to abuse the international trading system. So I think on this one, you know, we ought to all hope he succeeds and that he's tough enough and insists on on some structural reform. And it will also, in a remarkable comment, Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, said that by being tough and insisting on a good trade agreement, we will help reformers in China. A remarkable thing for him to say. It's absolutely true. The real problem is, and why I'm a little pessimistic, is Xi Jinping, who's made exercising political control the sine qua non of his regime and extending the influence of the party, I think is not willing to let Liu He have the kind of reform and opening up he wants. And my concern is that he won't go far enough, deep enough, and fast enough to satisfy people like Lighthizer who are around Trump and really want structural reform in the economy. Stay tuned.
Let me draw you out a bit on Xi Jinping, if I can, because when you were working for President Bush, you had a lot of personal dealings, I'm sure, with Chinese presidents and Chinese officials and leaders around the world. What do you make of Xi Jinping? When he came to office, I remember a lot of China experts at the time said, look, he's going to bide his time. It's going to take time for him to consolidate his power. They were completely wrong. He quickly consolidated his power and began moving aggressively externally to extend Chinese influence, to push red lines further out, to be much more forward-leaning in the South China Sea and in China's near seas generally, and to take a, you know, to have quite a deft political hand in many ways. I mean, I remember when Xi Jinping, I won't tell that story.
Oh, come on.
No, all right, fine. When Xi Jinping visited the Australian Parliament a few years ago, I remember he had made an unusual number of visits to Australia. And on this last visit, he visited Tasmania, which was the only Australian state he hadn't visited. And you would never find, for example, an American president who had visited every state in Australia. And Xi Jinping said something like, in his speech to the Parliament, he said something like, you know, on this trip, I visited Tasmania, the last Australian state. I've now visited every state and territory in Australia. And then he looked around, he paused for comic effect, and then looked around and said, do I get some sort of certificate for that? Which is a sort of a light touch you don't expect of a lifetime communist official. So he's this mix of hard and soft. He's at Davos. He's Davos man one day, but he's a very tough ideologue, a committed communist who's, as you say, is pushing the tentacles of the Chinese Communist Party further and further into Chinese life and indeed into the lives of the national lives of other countries such as Australia. So what's your observation? Is he a really, really historical figure that we will look back on in years to come and say he made a huge difference to the Chinese destiny?
The question, so you have at the Lowy Institute, and I just had lunch with him today, Richard McGregor, who is a wonderful expert on China. And you should have him up here and ask him that question. I asked that to him at lunch, and he has a wonderful answer, and I'm going to plagiarize a little of it. And please, if you see him, tell him thank you very much. He's going to be a historic figure. The question is he going to be, and I'm going to say this pejorative, is he going to be Mao Zedong, who made a lot of horrible mistakes at the end of his administration? Or is he going to be Deng Xiaoping, who is really responsible for the emergence of a prosperous, powerful Chinese state? And the jury is out. The jury is out. He is a formidable leader. I'll give you another example. So he goes to ASEAN. And the Vice President Pence goes to ASEAN. Vice President Pence, like every American, you know, jets in, has his detail around him, is in the bubble, you know, gives his speeches, stays for half the time, goes home. Xi Jinping comes, stays for 3 days, meets and talks to each of the heads of government of the ASEAN countries. Makes a fantastic impression. He's formidable. He's also really tough, but he lets his minions take the tough line, and he's the reasonable one. He's always the good cop, never the bad cop. Very deftly done. But the issue is going to be in terms of his legacy, because he's dismantled a lot of the things that Deng Xiaoping put in place, which are responsible for China's emergence and prosperity. I think he will not do the kind of reform and opening up that China needs if it's going to achieve its own economic goals. He has eliminated term limits, which was a brilliant move that Deng Xiaoping put in place. You have two terms. After 10 years, you're out. And he also instituted a regularized succession process, which put a lot of stability in the Chinese system. Xi Jinping has eliminated both of those things. It's not just that he's the tentacles of the party are going into society, but through this social credit system, you know, he's going to wire that society that if your kid wants to get into college, you better toe the line and do what the party wants. And once he's able to put that, because the technology will now allow it. I mean, if Joseph Stalin would have loved to have this device. And if he puts it in place, it's going to transform China. So the real question is, one, he's made a lot of enemies with his anti-corruption campaign. Will the Chinese people at some point rebel against this increasing authoritarianism and beginning to verge on totalitarianism? And what form will that take? And then secondly, will this economy continue to provide the kind of economic growth and prosperity that the Chinese people have come to expect and on which the party's legitimacy depends? So, you know, he'll get through the next 5 years. The question is 10, 15 years out. And I don't think we know.
I'm going to come to the audience in 1 minute and give you an opportunity to ask Steve a question. But first of all, let me finish with a question on Australia, if I may.
Yeah.
We sometimes feel pretty down about ourselves here at the moment. In May, we will likely, I think at this point, have a change in government, and that will mean the sixth or the seventh Prime Minister in the past decade, depending on how you count them. And this churn is pretty dispiriting, and I think it has certainly retarded Australian foreign policy and indeed Australian public policy on many different levels. But I know you're a bit of an optimist about Australia. So what do you think about us when you land?
So I have to make a disclaimer. One, I've only been to Australia twice. This is my second time.
Both times he visited the Lowy Institute.
To everything I know about Australia comes from this man right here, who gave us a long, my wife and I, a list of books we should read. I, of course, read none of them. My wife read all of them and would give me summaries, so I feel I've gotten educated. So, you know, what am I to say anything about Australia? But I've got some statistics to share. So, and my thesis is Australia is, in some sense, punching above its weight, but way below its potential, and way below what it needs, and what, quite frankly, the democratic world needs. And so I thought, comparing Australia with South Korea, and I would say to you, South Korea has a much higher profile, and I would say much more impact in the region than Australia. Why should that be? Yes, South Korea has twice the population, 50 million, you have 25 million. But your economy is almost as big as South Korea's. Theirs is 1.65 trillion, yours is 1.53 trillion GDP in nominal terms. So why does South Korea have so much higher impact than Australia? There was this wonderful article in October of 2018 in The Economist, I hope you all saw it, you know, a celebration of how well Australia has done in terms of its economy and in terms of its immigration policy. It says a little, your politics has fallen off a little bit in terms of its performance. But
so
you know,
so is yours.
We lead the way. But you are a huge success story and huge potential. But you're underperforming. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in the Middle East, and every Middle East country has a Vision 2030, Vision 2025, Vision 2035. Where is Australia's Vision 35? Where are you going? There's a whole new set of technologies. Where are you in harnessing these technologies, which are going to be the foundation for prosperity in the 21st century? And instead, you're selling coal and iron ore? I mean, come on, people. So I think you need a vision for Australia. And I think it's time for you to step up and have more an influence. Why isn't there a Samsung type of company in Australia? It makes no sense. So I would just, I think this is a great country to the extent I know, and I love your people. And I think, you know, the world needs you, and your own future generations need you to do more. And someone said, well, you need a plan. And then someone said, well, you need a man or a woman to present the plan. And so I'm looking forward. You know, remember the Japanese were in this position with probably more prime ministers in a period of time than you had. And everybody was bemoaning the Japanese political system. And then you got Shinzo Abe, who was a man with a plan. You can complain about it, but he's had an agenda. I would hope, that's what I would hope for Australia.
All right, speaking of stepping up, who wants to step up and ask Mr. Hadley a question now that he's made us feel great about ourselves? Australians love being flattered by visitors.
Thanks, Jeff Miller. My question goes back to the start of your remarks when you were talking about how President Trump became the spokesman and the embodiment of the felt plight of the working class in the US. What happened to the Democratic Party? Why weren't they the natural spokesman for that group?
If the Republican Party has now been captured by this new president, the Democratic Party is a party without a theme. It's a pudding without a theme at this point in time, and it doesn't really have a direction where it's going. It is in the process of trying to figure out that direction. For the moment, lots of people are now running for president. Good news, a lot of those are women. That's a wonderful thing. All of them are quite left on the political spectrum. And there's really nobody at this point that has taken the middle lane, the more pragmatic lane. Everybody hopes Joe Biden comes in. I mean, come on, 74 years old, whatever he is. Can't this baby boomer generation get off the stage? And can't the younger generation step up? But so far, they really have not. And Peggy Noonan wrote a column some months ago, which I thought was interesting. And she was talking about Howard Schultz. She said, Howard Schultz wants to be conservative economically and progressive in terms of social values. Actually, the United States is moving in the opposite direction. Wanting a sort of more, a lot of distrust of capitalism now because of the inequalities it has produced. So in some sense, becoming more criticism of capitalism and more conservative on social values. So the Democratic Party has not found a center of gravity and a candidate that can speak to the American people and take back those states that were traditional blue states that went red for Trump. And if they can't do that, and if there is not an economic downturn between now and the November election, Trump's going to have another 4 years. And Trump knows what is really true. If you're a president and you only have one term, you almost have no term, because chances are good in our politicized environment that the other party, when it comes in, will undo everything you did in your first 4 years. So you almost have to have two terms to even have one term. And Trump knows that. And by golly, he is focusing all his effort on winning. I talked to someone very close to him, very, very close to him, whose comment was, they just kept saying, we get a lot of resistance, but once we win a second term, everybody's going to have to deal with us. And I think that's what's in Trump's mind.
Just as an aside, Peggy Noonan, who Steve mentioned, is a great columnist for the Journal, but of course she was a speechwriter to President Reagan and then President George H.W. Bush. And she wrote a wonderful memoir of her work called What I Saw at the Revolution. And it had a great line in there about something Steve knows about, which is working at the White House. And she says, she said in that memoir, everyone who works at the White House goes through three phases. The first is, this is the White House, what am I doing here? And the second phase is, this is the White House, see, I deserve to be here. And the third phase is, this is the White House, what are all these other people doing here? But that's not Midwestern nice, so I know you, that thought would never have occurred to Steve. But it's a funny thought.
Can you just put your economic hat on for the moment and give your thoughts on the economic situation for the world over the next 3 to 5 years? The recession word looms, what do you think?
For the next 35 years?
Three to five years.
Sure. Well, I'm no economist. But in a variety of capacities, I try to follow it. You know, it's pretty remarkable that, you know, this economy is doing as well as it is. In terms of the American economy, it's a combination of the tax cut, particularly the corporate tax cut, the deregulation, and unfortunately, a lot of fiscal stimulation. And Trump has been able to buffalo the Fed so that they've stopped raising interest rates. And those four things have really perpetuated the American economy, which is doing quite well. And you now find, for the first time in a long time, real wages are going up. I mean, Trump can make an argument that he has, quote, fixed the U.S. economy. He certainly has it performing, but in terms of the deficit, the failure to address entitlements, you know, we bought a lot of long-term problems. Globally, unfortunately, you know, every time they tell you that there's a consensus among economists, you can bet that in about 6 months, it's going to reverse and they're all going to be wrong. That's my reading. And so, you know, 9 months ago when people were saying, oh, there's a consensus, this is the best global economy there's ever been, I started to sell my stock, figuratively. I did sell some stock, actually. But, you know, the uncertainty of trade war with China, for example, the problems Europe continues to have, distracted by its internal problems, distracted by Brexit, the global economy is getting shaky. And, you know, the U.S. economy still holds it up pretty well. But, you know, business cycle, we haven't suspended the laws of business cycles. So it's, my view is it's a matter of when. We're late in the cycle. At some point, there will be a downturn. And the question is how long and how deep. And the problem, as you know, is we're almost out of ammunition for bringing it back. Interest rates, we didn't get them ratcheted up as high as we should have, so we can bring them down once we're in a recession. And everybody's running these enormous deficits, so we don't have much fiscal power we can do. So the problem, I think, is the next one, it may not be deep like 2008, but, you know, it may be tough to get out of. And the last point I would say, that's the problem with really the recession in 2008. It's taken a long time to get to recover from it. And some people would say we haven't yet recovered, and now we're likely pretty soon to come down to another one. So 3 to 5 years, if there's not a recession in the next 3 to 5 years, then we've suspended the laws of economics, so far as I can tell.
Hi, my name is Claire Woodwell. With regards to Xi Jinping, just with the US approach maintaining like a firm approach to that situation, knowing that Xi Jinping politically cannot back down from those situations and cannot be seen to be folding underneath US pressure, do you think that there's a certain element to that, that the US is hoping that China will be forced to refocus their efforts domestically and deal with the economic situation in order to kind of counter some of the military threat that we're seeing from China with regards to expansion into other regions?
Not sure I fully understood your question.
So do you think that there's a certain element that the US is hoping they will be able to maintain this firm stance, and therefore China will be forced to focus on their domestic situation to...
What you mean.
So that they cannot continue the reach that they're currently projecting in the international sphere and be brought back.
It's a very interesting question, and it could be a strategy. I don't think it is the administration's strategy, and I don't think it would work. The question was, are we trying to put pressure on Xi so he's forced to focus on internal problems and therefore will be less interventionist internationally? I don't think that is the strategy, and I don't think it would work. The world is very different now, and people say, well, it's the rise of China, and, you know, it's a great power conflict. You know, the rise of China has been paralleled by the rise of India, which, of course, is behind China and is not yet the engine, but it is certainly the emergence of a major power on the world stage. You know, Indonesia in another 50 years, 25, 30 years, if they hold it together, is going to be a major player. Africa is coming on a big way. This is a much more complicated world. And of the China piece, the United States, speaking of the United States, we've never faced a potential competitor like China. You know, Russia was a military power and an economic pygmy. This is a major economic power that is in the process of becoming a major military power that is very strategic. This Belt Road Initiative, which is basically spreading China's influence all the way to Europe, is a very bold geostrategic move on their part. You can't divert it. You can't hold them down, notwithstanding that the Chinese think that's our strategy. We're going to have to deal with them. And my view is the relationship is going to be much more competitive. And the problem is, if it's only competitive, it'll become adversarial. And if it becomes adversarial, the risk of confrontation and conflict will go up. The problem is there are a lot of things we need to cooperate on with China if they're going to reach the China dream or we're going to reach the American dream. You have to deal with terrorism. You have to deal with pandemics. You have to deal with environmental damage. You have to fix the financial system. You know, all a long series of global problems that both countries need solved and neither country can solve on its own. So there ought to be a huge theater for cooperation, and there needs to be. So the question is, can we be strategic competitors and strategic cooperators at the same time? And there are few historical precedents for that. My own country is not very well structured to deal with that. We don't do nuance well. You know, are you with us? Are you against us? Are you friend? Are you foe? We're going to have a much more nuanced approach. And in the United States, I think, and I think in a way you led us a little bit there, and the Europeans, I think, are now catching up. Everyone is finally understanding the challenge presented by China. But I only think we're just beginning to come up with a strategy and policy of how to deal with it. There's a lot of work to be done by your institute, by think tanks, because we haven't figured this one out. And there are not a lot of historical precedents.
But just to ask a follow-up question on that, I mean, that's quite a conciliatory message that you've just given in terms of balancing cooperation and competition. And it's an unusual one to get from an American visitor at the moment, and there does seem to be a hardening consensus in the United States on the strategic side, leave aside the economic issues, that the United States has been too soft towards China and they've taken you for a ride and now you need to push. And how do you feel, is that a correct judgment, and what do you think about that view?
Well, the view has hardened, and I'll give you on both sides, and I'm not going to do this right, I wrote something about it, but Americans see China as diplomatically aggressive, an economic predator, a military threat, and an ideological challenge that is in some sense trying to undermine the American political system. And the Chinese, of course, see us as trying to protect our position at the top of the international order at their expense, trying to undermine their political system, hold down their economy, and contain them from having greater international influence. So the elites of the two countries couldn't have a more negative view. And the change in the last 3 to 5 years is unbelievable in terms of the hardening of views. I used to be sort of a hawk on China. I'm now probably viewed by most people as tough. Where I would square it up is I think I'm right about strategic competition, strategic cooperation. The question is how you get there. And what I would say, one of the ways we have to get to there is we have to show China that we are back in the game. That if they want to have a competitive-only relationship, we're prepared and we will beat them in that competitive relationship. You know, this is the talk about, you know, these new technologies, artificial intelligence. What are we going to do about artificial intelligence? What are we going to do about 5G, which Huawei is giving to the world? We're not in the game. We have not made the investments to put ourselves into a position where we can compete effectively with China, and we have to do that for two reasons. One, I think that's the only way you will get China to agree, hold on here, we don't want to just compete. I don't think we can crush these folks. Maybe we need to cooperate them. And secondly, we've got to have a hedge in the event the Chinese do want a confrontational relationship. They don't now. And it's remarkable. There was an article in the Financial Times about how China is not being as aggressive against the United States as Russia and Iran hoped it would be. She doesn't, at this point, want a head-to-head competition with the United States. That's a good thing. And that's why I think we have to keep open this potential for cooperation. But make no mistake, if we're going to get them to go in that direction, we're going to have to show that we're able to compete with them, to stay with them, and if necessary, if they want to go to head-to-head competition, we're ready and we'll win. It sounds so. I'm both, you know, some sense too soft and probably too hard. And you know, take the average. I'm right in the middle.
Steve, I'm going to finish by asking you about the administration in which you served. We're in an interesting period because there's quite a lot of Bush nostalgia at the moment with the passing of Barbara Bush and George H.W. Bush. Perhaps with the contrast with President Trump, the decorum, to use your word, with which President Bush has conducted himself since he left office. Of course, I'm old enough to remember how visceral was the contempt and the dislike that was expressed towards President Bush during the administration, sometimes by the same people, actually, who are now saying he's actually a pretty good guy. How does that? That strikes me as an interesting experience for you. I mean, you lived through the cauldron of the Bush administration, the decision to go into Iraq, and afterwards. How do you think when you look back on it? Do you feel that? I think President Bush actually said many times that he was happy to be judged by history.
Yeah.
And do you think that history's view is changing on the Bush administration?
I think it is. You know, one of the nice things about George H.W. Bush's funeral and the events that surrounded it is I think he finally got his due in terms of his contribution to history as president and what he stood for as a person. And I think that was great. You know, I have a lot of people come up to me and say, oh, President George H.W. Bush was so wonderful. And I always say to them, did you vote for him? No, most of the times they did. But, you know, I think in some sense it's also an end of an era. You know, we're not going to go back to those days. George W. Bush, much more complicated legacy. You know, it's the old story, you know, Henry Kissinger asked Zhou Enlai, what do you think about the results of the historical significance of the French Revolution? Zhou Enlai thought for a minute, he said, too soon to tell. So, as George W. Bush says, you know, historians are still writing new books about the first George W., that is to say, George Washington, 250 years later. You know, I'm content to, you know, let the history right about me. But I think there has been he's a very decent man, George W. Bush. He has been a model in his retirement. Obama administration was not as bad as Trump. You know, Trump would say that Obama and Bush were the two worst presidents we've ever had in history. Obama administration wasn't quite that bad, but they were very negative about Bush and very dismissive of him. And he kept his tongue and cultivated a good relationship with the Obamas, particularly Mrs. Obama. Secondly, in retirement, he's done a lot of public events, and people have seen the person we saw every day, but that the American people never saw when he was president. He's unguarded, he's funny, he's irreverent, he's smart. He's on a bit of a boomlet, and, you know, the comparison helps. But in the end of the day, how will Iraq work out? How will the Middle East work out? I mean, these are questions we won't know for a long time.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've run out of time. In his recent testimony to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, I noted that Steve said as follows. He said, when global leadership became too burdensome for a Great Britain exhausted by the Second World War, it passed the torch to the United States. More than half a century later, many Americans are ready to pass the torch to someone else. The problem is, sadly, that there is no one else. I agree with that, and I also think that for smart, sober foreign policy analysis, there is no one else like Steve Hadley. So thank you very much, Steve, for being with us.